Prozac has had a black box warning since 2004 that it is related to homicidal and suicidal ideation. Make that make sense for me. That we're hopping people on medications and then we're surprised when they're actually, the side effects are displaying themselves.
Yeah, exactly. It's something that when you really start to think about it, it really doesn't make sense. It's like, okay, here's your antidepressant. The side effects of your antidepressant, well, it might be constipation, might be diarrhea, might make you tired all the time, but also give you insomnia so you can't sleep at night, might cause sexual dysfunction. Well, you're just basically listing the side effects of depression too. And so I'm gonna take a medication that might make me more suicidal and is going to give me all the physical manifestations of my depression. How does this make sense? Especially when it's, you know, marginally more effective than placebo. It doesn't make much sense to me anymore.
Welcome to Love and Life. I'm Dr. Karen Anderson-Abril, here with my co-host,
Pastor Elliot Anderson.
And Love and Life is your place to hear conversations grounded in psych research, psychotherapy,
and biblical truth
to help us thrive in love and life.
Over the last couple years, we started a series called Empowered Evolving, in part because I was seeing so much shifting all around us. Beliefs that had once been considered integral to folks with certain philosophical ideology now seem to be embraced by those on the polar opposite side of things. Furthermore, over the last several years, we've witnessed the abolition of core American rights I thought we all valued. Very strange times we're living through, indeed. I called the series Empowered Evolving as a way to remind myself and anyone else who might have been feeling unsettled, as I've been feeling over the last several years, to remind myself and anyone else that evolving is empowered. That's one of the core values that I just spoke to a moment ago. We used to encourage people to question authority and do your own research and think for yourself and ask for second, third, and fourth opinions. We warned each other to resist tribalism and groupthink. Americans were pioneers, independent-minded. We read Thoreau's Civil Disobedience in high school and lived by Shakespeare's To Thine Own Self Be True. And naturally, when you live out such principles, you often evolve. But evolving can feel lonely. You may lose friends, your community, even your identity. This all happened to today's guest, former psychiatric nurse turned holistic health coach, Dave Wayne. Before we get into the interview, let me share a little bit more about Dave. Dave Wayne worked as a registered nurse in an inpatient psychiatric setting for a decade, seeing firsthand the suffering of patients at the hands of predatory pharmaceutical companies made him cynical about the current state of our healthcare system. The scandals around Vioxx and OxyContin were what first opened his eyes to the staggering depth of the problem, and Dave was distressed to learn that the situation with psychiatric medications was similar. His health coaching journey began after discovering the carnivore community. There he heard people describe incredible turnarounds in their health through changing their diet to something that nobody within the healthcare establishment was recommending or taking seriously. People who completely reversed their severe autoimmune diseases were also reporting, almost as a happy side effect, improvements in their mental health, including the resolution of their anxiety and depression, all while going off of meds instead of adding more. As both a registered nurse and primal health coach, Dave is specifically interested in helping people avoid, reduce, or eliminate their use of psychiatric medications. My conversation with Primal Health Coach David Wayne, right after this. We want to take a moment to say a quick thank you to our community for supporting our sponsor, The Wellness Company. We've been so thrilled to partner with their team of esteemed medical professionals, including Dr. Peter McCullough, Dr. Harvey Risch, Dr. Drew Pinsky, and other truth-seeking doctors we can trust. Many of us are feeling some post-pandemic uncertainty, which makes perfect sense because now they're talking about this disease X that's supposedly about to break out at any time.
But we can take charge of our health and prepare ourselves for natural disasters or man-made threats with the Wellness Company's Medical Emergency Kit. It's the ultimate safeguard for your family. The kit includes vital medications like ivermectin, amoxicillin, and Z-Pak, with a comprehensive guidebook researched and written by the company's chief medical board. Visit twc.health/lovelife and use promo code LOVELIFE for an exclusive 15% discount. That's twc.health/lovelife and promo code LOVELIFE, all one word, for 15% off your order.
David, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Yeah, happy to be here.
Yeah, I really appreciate you coming on. We have, I think we align based on what I saw from just the online presence. We align on some, what I believe to be very crucial and critical concerns in the mental health community and professionals. And I'm always looking, because Elliot and I talk a lot about trying to be more holistic in our approach to life in general. And certainly we know that there are big factions of society that have their own agendi. And you have this very interesting experience coming from what it appears to be one end of the spectrum to really moving through, seeing things in a way that you, I'm sure, as a young professional did not see them, and then coming out on the other end. So if you could just introduce yourself to the audience and let them know a little bit about your professional background and kind of how you got to where you are now.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, you're right. It has been a journey. So I did a lot of random careers as a young man, graduated with a degree in English, worked for an archaeology company, did some graphic design, did some web development. So was trying out lots of different careers and basically looking for something that felt like it could be a lifelong career, and started volunteering as a first responder, actually, and that was my introduction into the healthcare system. So started as a first responder, upgraded to EMT, was thinking of upgrading to paramedic. I was actually doing some EMT clinicals, and a nurse at the hospital where I was doing my clinicals said, "Don't be a paramedic, you should get into nursing." And it was great advice, so that's what I did. When I was in nursing school, I was working at a Walgreens pharmacy, so did that for a while. And then in nursing school, I was interested in emergency medicine. That's where I saw myself going. But my senior year, when we were placed in clinical rotations, nobody signed up for the psych rotation. And I was placed there as a senior, and it just really clicked. So that's where I went after nursing school. I went to a hospital inpatient psychiatric unit.
Yeah, and I think it's funny because having majored in psychology myself, and I remember doing our rotation, I guess it was an internship rather, practicum probably is better described in the undergrad level, at the state hospital, psychiatric hospital in Illinois. And I was more like, oh, I definitely would have signed up for that rotation had I been in your shoes. But it sounds like you kind of stumbled into this realm. And once you got there, obviously then you stuck with it, you enjoyed it. What did you see? And I would imagine also in emergency rooms, you would have some folks who were suicidal. That would happen outside of the psych unit per se. That would happen in the general hospital as well.
Yeah, absolutely. What drew me there more than anything was the staff who were there. They had really, they had good leadership, and they had built a really good unit environment, not just with the staff, but with the building itself. They built a brand new psych building less than a year after I started there. So we had a great, modern, brand new building that didn't feel all cinder blocky and institutionalized like a lot of psych units do. And it was filled with great staff, just some of the best people you could ever hope to work with. So that was a big part of what drew me into that environment and made me want to be there.
And I think that's a really important point, because when I share my concerns with pharma in general, and certainly psychotropic medication as it relates to, goodness, I mean, from the DSM all the way down to just the average general practitioner. You walk into the office and they'll be like, hey, you've been feeling low? Here, take some SSRIs. Just the casual approach to it. I think when I come out with my very, very firm feelings, and that people feel like I'm vilifying the professionals who take a medical model to mental health and emotional well-being. And so I think it's important what you just said. These people are, they're not evil. They truly want to help in the best way that they understand how to help. But it sounds like through your experience, you started seeing that a medical model, pharmaceuticals at the ready all the time, first response to any kind of issue or concern, was not helping the patients.
Yeah, absolutely. But it took me a really long time to get there, actually. When I first heard the phrase big pharma used in a derogatory manner while I was working at Walgreens, it felt conspiratorial to me. And, you know, I had just basically gotten into healthcare at that point, but it just did not seem plausible at all to me that these companies with thousands of employees could be engaging in these mass conspiracies. You know, I figured there would be whistleblowers. I figured the FDA would step in and make things right. And it just did not seem plausible to me at all. So I just dismissed it. And people who would kind of rail about big pharma, I didn't take them seriously at all. That was the attitude that I had in nursing school as well. But I started on a journey as I started to see these lawsuits happening. And they were lawsuits about drugs that I had dispensed to people at the pharmacy or given to people as a nurse. And when you started to see some of the revelations that would come out of the lawsuits, it basically planted a seed, and it started to make me more open-minded to just how bad things could be, and more open-minded to how it actually didn't take a giant conspiracy of thousands of people. It just took a few people in the right positions of power to really unleash incredibly devastating catastrophes upon the American public, like, you know, Vioxx. Vioxx was pulled off the market just after I started at Walgreens. And at the time it was pulled off, the narrative was, you know, the problem isn't Vioxx, it's just that people stopped taking their baby aspirin, and that's why so many people are having heart attacks. That's what we were told to tell patients and customers who were worried about it at the time. I also saw, you know, the opioid epidemic with OxyContin and other narcotics just really having an incredibly negative impact on so many lives and killing so many people. And then years and years later, you start hearing about these lawsuit revelations where you're able to, you know, read emails between executives, and you learn about things that are discussed in meetings at the top levels of these companies, and you go, oh my God, is it like this at all these companies? Is it like this for all medications? And if you have the courage and integrity to start taking a deep dive, you unfortunately find out yes. And so that's what happened to me with the psychotropic medications that I was really good at convincing people to start taking in my jobs as psych nurse. I fully believed in the start of my career as a nurse that these medications were fixing a chemical imbalance. That's what my textbook said. That's what my clinical instructors would say, that's what my preceptors would say, that's what my mentors would say, that's what our doctors would say. They would put it right in the patient's note. They would tell the patients, this is what's going to fix the chemical imbalance that's causing your mental health symptoms. And I believed it, and I participated in that for years and years and years before I started to really question that, and before I started to recognize the harm that these medications could possibly do to people that we were, in my opinion, missing on a very regular basis.
That is, I think, something that when you do open up the possibility that you did, and as you mentioned, initially, people have a lot of resistance to that. I think some of it, I don't want to be hyperbolic, but some of it's so horrific. You just really don't even want to believe that people could be so callous. Now, I'm talking about people in the top, perhaps. I'm not talking about the practitioners. They are like you. They really believe that. That's what the textbook said. That's what their professor said. They really believe this is the best approach. But when you look at the big corporations, and they I mean, let's be honest, they benefit if we're sick. They don't benefit if we get well. We've moved from healthcare to sick care, I believe, in this country. And I mean, you can take a real deep dive into that and look at the early 20th century with the Rockefeller Foundation buying up all the medical schools and that sort of thing. But again, you start talking about this with an average person and they can be very, again, looking at you like you're conspiratorial. And for me as a psychologist, it's always been frustrating because the medical model, it provides this, and the marketing's brilliant. You know, Eli Lilly did their job. So it's that serotonin that's troubling you. That's what's getting you in your way. You just don't have the right level. And yet, to me, to tell someone who is grieving or deeply in despair because of whatever life happened to throw their way, and to dehumanize that experience, that emotion, and just write it off as a chemical imbalance, to me, that's cruel to me. And I know no one is thinking of it that way when they're prescribing, but I try to look at the deeper level. What are we telling someone? That being human is a flaw? You should be a robot with no emotions? That's where my mind goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel the same way. People have a right to experience grief. People have a right to experience joy. And what I learned is that these medications put up some sort of wall, some sort of barrier for people, between people and their own humanity. It takes away their ability to experience those ranges of emotion. It also takes away, their sexual being. It takes away their libido. It takes away their ability to function, sometimes to even have children. And when I started to learn about all these things, the first time I heard about post-SSRI sexual dysfunction and read some patient stories about that, and you know, it was something that it had been, you know, I'd been doing that job for about 9 years at that point, and I had never heard of, I had heard about sexual side effects, but I had never heard that they could be permanent. And I knew for a fact that nobody was telling patients that. Patients weren't being told that. And the very first patient that I talked to at the bedside about that told me that he started Paxil when he was 17, and he had been dysfunctional ever since. And he was in his mid-30s at that point, so half his life. And it completely impaired his ability to have a normal relationship, a normal romantic relationship, to ever have children. Those were just taken off the table for him by those medications.
I just saw something, and it's exactly to your point. And because these medications, which I know initially were not, no clinical trials on children, but SSRIs, and I don't know how they do this. When I say they, I don't know how a pharmacist or a physician, and maybe you know, do they just chop the pill in half and say, well, you're half the weight of an adult, so here, take it? Because I don't, and maybe some clinical trials have been done at this point with children, but the concern is exactly what you said, that there are children who've been on these antidepressants. I mean, they were giving them, well, they probably still are, to kids who are shy. Just take some Prozac. You won't feel that uncertainty. As if being shy is some horrible thing, that it's not a normal character trait that some people possess, which is fine. We're all different. We all have different traits and characteristics. But these kids who've been on SSRIs for so long, because it's affected their sexual development, even going through puberty, now some of them are claiming to be asexual. And I'm thinking, I doubt you're asexual. I think this is a medication injury. And you talked about informed consent, essentially, that isn't happening. And so talk a little bit about that, again, from your experience as being in psych units and as a psychiatric nurse.
Sure. Well, I feel like it almost feels like a factory assembly line, an inpatient psychiatric setting where it's, you know, does this person meet criteria? Okay. Even on the outpatient basis, you know, it's when you're in the system, well, we have to give you a diagnosis. You know, there has to be a diagnosis on file so we can bill insurance. Once you have a diagnosis, then you get dropped into the prescribing algorithm. If you're already in that algorithm for a while, it's like, okay, what tweaks to your meds are we going to make during this inpatient stay so that we can continue to bill for this hospitalization, because the insurance company is going to require something. So let's add this, or let's, you know, adjust this. And the entire time, though, these people who, like we've talked about, I do believe that the nurses and the providers have good intentions, but there are so many barriers in place to prevent them from knowing the risks and benefits of the medications that they're prescribing and that they're giving. And we see this again from lawsuits and from the lack of transparency we have around clinical trials and that sort of thing. You mentioned Eli Lilly and their brilliant marketing back when Prozac came out, and absolutely, that their chemical imbalance narrative that created back then, it completely captured us as a society and also as a medical system. So people have this expectation of a pill that's going to fix their woes, instead of having to do harder work of changing their lifestyle and their routines and addressing things like nutrition and exercise and sleep hygiene and having some purpose in life and having some connection to a community. It's way easier to just take a pill. And when so many people involved in that process aren't able to be well informed about what that pill is actually capable of, that's just a recipe for disaster. When there's a profit motive to keep that information under wraps and to control the dialogue around that medication by buying journals, by buying textbooks, by writing the patient education handouts. My hospital's vendor for patient education handouts was a company owned by Merck, the propagators of the Vioxx scandal that killed tens of thousands of Americans. So, it was right there in the handouts. The handout said, you know, depression's caused by a chemical imbalance and you'll probably need to be on medications for the rest of your life. And under side effects, it would say something very general along the lines of, sexual side effects might occur, and if they do, talk to your doctor. And there was nothing in there about protracted withdrawal, which I started to recognize we were seeing all the time on the unit with SSRIs and benzos, but not recognizing it. You know, if somebody was on Prozac for 20 years and they were switched off of it 6 months ago, they could very well still be having symptoms, and people would kind of get labeled as somatic or, you know, attention seeking, when really they had a very valid distress and physical complaints from being on that medication and being taken off of it so quickly. And it just wasn't on our radar. And there were all these barriers to keeping it from being on our radar.
And then if someone has that withdrawal symptom, then they can go, oh, I guess I am in distress. I am feeling horrible now. I guess I really do need this medication for the rest of my life. Although I follow the work of Dr. Peter Breggin. I'm sure you're familiar with his work. Way back when I was a young therapist, Prozac was kind of just making its splash. It was the early 90s, so it had been around a bit, but it was really revving up. And that book, Listening to Prozac, came out. And I read it. I remember going home and telling my dad, Dad, there's this new depression medicine. It's amazing. My father was just ahead of his time with some of the stuff. He was all into natural remedies for everything, went to the health food store all the time. We didn't even have like cough syrup in our house. He wasn't a hippie, but he had that hippie kind of approach to medicine. Yeah. And he just looked at me, he's like, absolutely not. He goes, listen, you have to understand the whole system, as you spoke to a minute ago, the whole system is in bed together, is how he put it. You've got the pharma rep who comes and wines and dines the doc and then gives them the free samples. The doc, and even psychiatrists, as you mentioned too, which I think is a horrible facet of our approach to helping people, is that we have to give them a diagnosis in order to have the insurance. Even if they don't want to have medicine, they have to have, if they want to use their behavioral health plan, they have to have a diagnosis, so the insurance will pay for it. And of course, insurance will pay for maybe 12 sessions a year with a talk therapeutic approach, but they'll pay for all kinds of meds. And so my dad was like, absolutely not. And then shortly after this, listening to Prozac, Dr. Peter Breggin came out with his Talking Back to Prozac, which is one of the seminal books of my philosophy about everything I do as a psychologist. I just really adore. He's just been a pioneer and just such an advocate for these concerns. And the research he looks at, there's no longitudinal effectiveness of any of this. There may be a couple week bump in mood, which is probably the placebo effect anyway. But it's so, and then you're rewiring your brain to the extent that you, all the things you've talked about with, I mean, libido, with people gain weight. I mean, you're depressed and now you don't want to have sex with your husband and you're gaining weight. Like, did that make things better? It's so simplistic and very, very harmful. But I'm curious what you have experienced. When I share some of this stuff, people oftentimes, they kind of glaze over. I probably should dial it down. I probably get too too enthusiastic because I just want to, I feel that people are being lied to, just to be just very blunt. I feel like people are being lied to and they don't know it because they're not in our field. So how would they know? We trust these authorities. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. So if I go to a lawyer, I'm assuming he's going to then advocate for me. If I go to a doctor, I'm assuming they're advocating for me. And these entities cannot be trusted, is what I believe. And so I get adamant, but back to the point, people's eyes glaze over, or they'll say, well, you know, Prozac saved my sister's life, or I was on Xanax for anxiety, and it's the best thing ever. How do you respond when people say, no, I love my drugs?
Yeah, good question. I agree. A lot of people's eyes do just kind of glaze over. And I have worked with patients who absolutely swear that these right. medications were life-changing and life-saving for them. And that's obviously a completely valid experience. I would say that for me, the people who sing the praises of psychotropic medications are few and far between. Most of the thousands of patients I've talked with over the years, you know, when I ask them how their meds are going, it's kind of like, well, they're okay, you know, it's all right. There's one of the most disturbing things about the work of Irving Kirsch with The Emperor's New Drugs was that, A, it's disturbing that it took FOIA requests to get the clinical trials to be released to the public. Like, if you're a doctor prescribing these and you're a patient taking these, why are the clinical trials hidden from you? And then in his analysis of them, looking at the just basically marginal difference between these drugs and placebo, if they were harmless, maybe that would be okay. But we also know that they didn't do due diligence in actually looking for harms. I mean, we talked a little bit about withdrawal, and in the clinical trials, they would give these drugs to people for 6 weeks. How can you possibly think that you have a handle on withdrawal after such a short amount of time, when at this point people have been on these medications for decades? So, I do think that, you know, coming from a hospital setting, if there is an environment where it's okay to be kind of liberal with these medications, it would be in an inpatient psychiatric setting where people are in acute crisis, where maybe somebody is floridly manic or psychotic and actively hallucinating, or they are literally so depressed that they can't get out of bed. Like, this is a time and place to try these things and to see if these help people, because there are occasions where they really do, and I've seen it. And people who've experienced that, that's certainly valid. But the narrative that, oh, well, that means you need to be on this for the rest of your life, that's marketing. That's not good patient care. The goal should always be to get people back on their feet and have them living their best lives on as little medication as possible, including no medication.
Yeah, I think that really speaks to where I would love to see our healthcare get to. Acute care, absolutely. I get into a car wreck and I break my leg, I need acute care. And Western medicine comes in with all its tools and it's wonderful. But looking at a Western medical model certainly for emotional and mental health, I don't think it has a lot to offer at this point, except for acute care. And I even a former colleague, when I was a professor, she was a clinical social worker, LCSW, and she was treating schizophrenic individuals without medication. She really believed even some of those very, and for so those of you not in the field, schizophrenia is not split personality, although that's sometimes it's characterized that way, but it's actually, it's when you break from reality. So you're hearing voices oftentimes, or you're believing delusions that like, that are just obviously not true. So it's a break from reality, and it's considered one of the most difficult mental illnesses to address. So I get excited when I see even some of these conditions that, this is not maybe a fair assessment, but it feels like sometimes people just give up on those. Like, oh, schizophrenia diagnosis, it's going to be lifelong medication forever. And it just sounds like your experience, yes, you see a role for medication at times in those acute instances, but the goal should always be to have that more holistic. And I just, again, it just speaks to people can have psychotic breaks. Life is hard. People can have that, but we don't have to see them and define them and label them. And again, it goes back to diagnosis, which is why I'm just not a fan of the DSM. And when we're always putting a label on someone, well, they identify with that label. They internalize it. Now I'm a schizophrenic, I'll always be a schizophrenic, rather than saying I went through a very, very difficult time. Maybe you lost several family members in a car accident or something, like that you would lose touch with reality for a period of time makes perfect sense, honestly. Most of our emotional responses make sense if you look at the context.
Yeah, they do, absolutely. There used to be, have you heard of Soteria houses?
Mm-mm.
They were in the 1970s and I think into the 1980s, they were these facilities that would take first episode psychosis patients and manage them in kind of a group setting where they would have trained techs just kind of keep people safe. And their outcomes were fantastic. The length of stay was comparable to an inpatient hospital stay, but they did it all without medication. And then their long-term outcomes were fantastic. People, you know, years later were way more likely to be employed, way more likely to have a family, way more likely to be contributing to society than patients that had been sent down the medication route, who were, all too often holding down a couch in a group home, just morbidly obese and having no quality of life.
Wow. That approach, again, it's unfortunately, maybe the 70s, again, they were maybe a little bit more holistic in with that hippie culture, which I say that with all love and respect, because as being someone who's pretty crunchy myself, I really admire those values. It just feels like there was a deeper respect, honestly, for humanity. And that's such a powerful way of framing and then treating an individual. I think about people like, you know, people even say in our vernacular, they'll say something, well, he went off his meds. And I'm thinking, like, that's why they were acting goofy or whatever the case may be. And I'm thinking, but that's the goal. That's the goal. And I think about people, you hear tragic stories of people, I mean, even some of these school shooters and this rampant violence. Well, Prozac has had a black box warning since 2004 that it is related to homicidal and suicidal ideation. Make that make sense for me, that we're hopping people on medications and then we're surprised when they're actually, the side effects are displaying themselves.
Yeah, exactly. It's something that when you really start to think about it, it really doesn't make sense. It's like, okay, here's your antidepressant. The side effects of your antidepressant, well, it might be constipation, might be diarrhea, might make you tired all the time, but also give you insomnia so you can't sleep at night, might cause sexual dysfunction. Well, you're just basically listing the side effects of depression too. And so I'm gonna take a medication that might make me more suicidal and is going to give me all the physical manifestations of my depression. How does this make sense? Especially right. When it's, you know, marginally more effective than placebo. It doesn't make much sense to me anymore.
Yeah. And I'm sure just knowing that you being in very much in that medical model, and then I'm sure there were some moments of you, like you said, you started looking at these lawsuits and looking at why aren't these clinical trials? Why aren't the results available? And started to question. And I'm sure there was part of you, though, having been in it, like anyone, this is my value system. I've been living this. I've been believing, I've been helping people. And then to have to kind of pull yourself out of that, I'm sure that was, whenever we have a paradigm shift, there can oftentimes be some resistance because we're thinking, no, that's how I saw the world. And this is a 180. And that's hard.
Yeah.
How was that for you personally?
It was awful. It was distressing. Yeah. It was, there's a framework of professional nursing called novice to expert. And the premise is when you start in a new environment as a nurse, you learn from your preceptors and your mentors and your doctors, and you get on the job experience. And as time progresses, you become more of an expert in your field until you get to the point where you're the one precepting people and you're the one people turn to when they have questions. And I progressed along that line. I became a charge nurse. I chaired committees. I took on challenges. I kept things interesting for myself and kept learning and really thriving in that system. And got to the point where I won an Excellence in Nursing Award. I was incredibly proud of that. It was kind of a pinnacle. And that was at the exact same time that I was starting to go down these rabbit holes about what actually was in the clinical trials and about some of these scandals and about some of the issues with SSRIs and with metabolic syndrome and with protracted benzodiazepine withdrawal. And I all of a sudden, felt like I was a novice again, except I hadn't changed environments and I also didn't have mentor to look to around there for guidance. And yeah, that was awful. It was very distressing to me. I was starting to wonder if I was participating in a system that was doing more harm than good. And I can completely understand people who choose to put up maybe some cognitive dissonance, who choose to not go down those rabbit holes, not believe those awful things that they're participating in. It's part of how they guard themselves and part of how they convince themselves that they're doing good in the world. And it's way easier to just kind of label these anti-psychiatry doctors as fringe and as conspiracy theorists and like, oh, these doctors and influencers who are steering people away from psych meds, they're harming people. These patients who aren't on their medications, they're being damaged, and it allows them to kind of take this intellectual and moral high ground. Mm-hmm. I bet that's a lot nicer than things have been for me, because it's not been fun to have your belief system kind of crumble underneath you.
Mm-hmm. Obviously, Dave and I have a lot in common. We align on our values around these concerns. So this episode will be brought to you in two parts. So part one is complete for today, and we will bring part two this Thursday. I do want to recommend for anyone who is interested in tapering off psychotropic medications, please do so with the help of a professional like Dave, because just going cold turkey can be very, very difficult, as we talked about in the episode. So please reach out to Dave. He can be found at describe.health. That's DESCRIBE.health. Thank you, as always, for listening and for joining us today. Please let us know if you have any questions or any topics you would like us to cover on Love and Life. Remember, we're all about mind, body, and spirit for holistic thriving in love and life. And until next time, make it a great week.
Love and Life is produced by Tim May and hosts and executive producer, Dr. Karen Anderson-Abril.